Welcome to Hyperlocal, a podcast dedicated to inspiring economic developers, job creators, and community champions. I'm your host, Mason Ainsworth. Today is a fascinating episode. Paul and I are going to take you on a journey deep into thought, not just about the statistics of economic development, but the reason, the question of to what end? Why are we doing all this work, and what are the things that we should be thinking about when we're talking about building cities of the future, when we're talking about economic development, and we're talking about how to bring people together to make sure that we develop infrastructure for the human spirit? Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to share some exciting news. Hyperlocal just leveled up and is now supported by Storied Places Media, which specializes in producing audio and video podcasts for economic development organizations. Their all-inclusive packages are the way to go. Your Storied Places will basically do everything for you, from providing a host that understands economic development to editing the episodes for you and even writing your social media posts. Or if you have a person or a team that wants to take the lead, Storied Places can fill in the gaps and keep them on track. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast but don't have the time or the know-how, now is the time to get started, and Storied Places Media can help. Learn more about their services and clients at storiedplaces.ca. Now, let's get into it. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, thank you for making time for me to speak with your followers. It's a pleasure to be here, pleasure to share some ideas and hopefully some ideas that will make a difference.
Awesome. Well, happy to do that. And also just wanted to give a special shout out to Heather Hall for taking the time to invite you into our class and make that introduction. I think, you know, meeting folks, especially face-to-face, is such a great opportunity to develop that network, but also to learn from the best like yourself and be able to ask questions. And I know I asked you a few that day, and I'm excited to ask you some more today.
Well, I'm excited to have this conversation. So it's great.
Perfect. So Paul, the way I usually start off the podcast is getting into folks' origin story or their personal story. And I know that you've been disrupting traditional city building strategies with joy. From your time as the VP of Brand Marketing and Creativity for Research in Motion to creating your own consulting firm, Paul Consulting, Inc., you're also a published co-author of The Joy Experiments. I'm curious, what sparked your passion for new city building strategies? And to quote you, moving beyond traditional quality of life measures to prioritizing the economic, social, and environmental benefits of infrastructure for the human spirit, end quote. I love that quote, by the way, and especially the part about the human spirit. But I'm curious how your journey throughout life led you to doing this work and to where you are today.
I will try to answer that without it being an answer that, you know, is very, very long. Most of my career was really actually in the world of marketing, and it involved working with brands that had to be placed into popular culture in some fashion. Most notably for me, it was 10 years leading the charge of brand strategy for BlackBerry. And in that role, I was constantly trying to figure out how to place the product into popular culture and what was going on in popular culture. How do we organize ourselves as humans, as a society? And I was doing a lot of traveling to a lot of amazing cities around the world, most of the cities that were part of the innovation economy. And I was constantly sort of just, it was part of my job to sort of just look and observe and understand what was going on in terms of how people align themselves, how do thriving cities operate, and why do some cities not operate that way. After my years at Research in Motion, I was asked to work on a special project for a segment of Waterloo Region. And that focus was, how can we attract the world-class talent we need in the innovation economy? And how can public space create the right type of vibrance to attract those people? Because when you're world-class talent, you can work anywhere you want in the world. That's kind of the way it works. And so how can we compete against them? I was asked to do that for a couple of reasons. One, as mentioned earlier, I had been to most of the cities that Waterloo Region would have competed against, so I knew where the bar truly was. Secondly, I had direct experience in trying to hire those types of people and finding out how difficult it can be. And then finally, I gather I'm pretty good at taking big fuzzy concepts, shaping them into concrete ideas, taking the abstract and shaping it into something concrete, and then giving a vision to it that's motivating to people. So it was through that I started really getting in depth into what makes cities thrive and what type of city will succeed in the future as the innovation economy and the whole concept of ideas being the main product of that continues to take over. I tend to relate the story that at the turn of the 19th century, from the 19th century into the 20th century, the idea of the railroad, whether you've got the railroad, whether your town got the railroad or not, determined your success in the future. And I think innovative talent and innovative ideas is the railroad of today. And if you can attract those types of people, your community will have prosperity. And if you don't attract those, you will have a difficult time.
Super interesting. Innovative people are the railway of today. I like how you explain that. That really paints the picture for me. And I think that is bang on. And I know coming from a government background, when you have some of those innovative players in a community, you can really make some substantial changes in a positive way. But if you don't have that, it's still possible, but it's definitely a lot harder.
Exactly.
So Paul, jumping ahead, I know I mentioned briefly in the intro, the joy experiments. For those who are listening who might be unaware, can you tell us a bit about the book that you co-authored, the story behind it, and why economic developers and others should read it?
The book was created by a client of mine and myself. We put it together, that client being Scott Higgins from HIP Development. So he's a real estate developer. And going back to part of the answer in the previous question, where I talked about I was hired by aspects of the Waterloo region to come up with a strategy, I did come up with that strategy, and it was called Creative Intersections. And the idea was to take all the world-class activity going on within buildings and offices around Waterloo region, give it to installation artists who can create outdoor moments of play that convey some of that story to people so that the people in the region could actually start to understand what goes on in places like the Perimeter Institute, what goes on in places like Research in Motion at that time, and start to say, hey, this is us, because they're out playing with it. It's turned into a sculpture. It's turned into some form of art. It's turned into some sort of game, and it's filling public squares with activity. And they start to say, this is who we are. This is who we will continue to become, as opposed to only defining ourselves by who we have been in the past. That strategy was adopted by Scott Higgins on a large project that he was doing. And so he asked me to come and consult with him to figure out how to bring that whole strategy to life at a place called Gaslight, the Gaslight District in Cambridge, Ontario. That led to Scott and I working on numerous projects where we were trying to continually create spaces and activities where people will come together and engage with each other, create a sense of vibrancy, create a sense of identity and community. As we were doing that, Scott felt the need to create a bit of a manifesto so that stakeholders in the community would understand why he's trying to do more than what he was asked to do. And I often jokingly say, nothing gets people more suspicious of a real estate developer than when they actually do more for you than when asked. So we started working on, manifesto language, which tends to be kind of corporate poetry that can go on a coffee mug or a poster. And none of that was really cutting it. At the time, I was reading a book by the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, and he was writing why he did the things he did while he was mayor. And the book was called Nation City, I believe. And I said to Scott that you should write a book, not a manifesto. You should write a book about why you're doing what you're doing right now, as opposed to waiting until you've done it all. And that book led to Scott and I co-writing it, because Scott was very generous in giving me that ability and that offer. And the book is really a journey through our projects. And we treated those projects as experiments. And the book sort of outlines what we felt worked, what we learned, and touches on the moments where things didn't go the way we wanted to and what we learned. The book was written during COVID. And at that time, we started to realize that this idea of creating vibrancy and bringing people together to play in public, to have engaging spaces, was not just about economic development anymore. We could see the world becoming more divided, more isolated. We could certainly feel the pain in COVID. And we started to realize that there is a very strong societal need for these types of spaces and this type of activity throughout society, throughout every city. And the book started to take on a much more societal message, I would say. And as a result, today, much of my work is to work on urban projects, work with cities to elevate their activity and elevate their strategies to the societal level, where connecting citizens to each other is really what it's all about.
Amazing. Elevating strategies to society. I think that's such a cool concept. I know previously, Paul, you talked a bit about agency and connection. I'm curious, what would it look like to prioritize designing public spaces that foster that genuine connection between citizens through shared experiences where people have that regular agency over what unfolds in those spaces?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of work on this idea because I find that it needs a lot of support and it needs a lot of definition. Let me start with the word joy. Our definition of the word joy is the feeling that you get when you feel connected to something or someone beyond yourself. You know you're not alone. You know you are connected into something. You belong. Whether that's an organization, whether that's people, or whether that's just a universal thought that you get through meditation. You are outside yourself, you belong to something, and you are participating. That's what joy is, and that was the North Star for Scott and I on many of our projects. And that requires a different type of experience in cities that really doesn't happen that much, because we're still designing spaces to meet the needs of probably about 30 years ago. Belonging, connection, activity is very important to the objective of what I'm talking about. And that requires open-ended experiences where it requires you to start doing something, it requires somebody else to start doing something, it requires you and a group of people who you may not even know to start figuring out the rules of what it is we're doing. What I'm talking about is not, well, there's a baseball diamond over there, and there's a swing over here, and there's a park bench there. Those are nice things to have, and it allows you to play in a city, but it doesn't allow you to play with the city or play as a city. So a lot of the work that I do is to work with landscape architects and various other forms of city designers and planners to embrace the idea that you're not designing a solution for people in public spaces. You are not saying, well, we will create some infrastructure and this is where people will sit and that's where people will look and that's where people will do something else. But something where we're not sure what you as the public will do. And I tell designers to actually don't think like designers who are there to try and design a solution. Think more like artists. Well, one thing about art is really not very good at giving you answers, but it is very good at inviting you into questions. And our public spaces should be environments where people are invited into the question of what type of community do we want to be? What type of community do we need to become in order to thrive in the future? And through public play, people start trying to figure out different roles and starting to realize, hey, we're different. You don't look like anyone in my algorithm, but we seem to be doing something here. And the fact that you're different than me is actually an asset in us getting something to happen, some joy and some fun. And in the process, these public spaces are where we start to feel like there's a chance for us to actually be a community. But in order to do that, you have to hand over agency and control to the public. You have to not make the rules so defined. I think public spaces that create real joy, collective joy, are designed to be more like a form of performance art, where it doesn't turn into what it really is until the performers, the public, get involved and start figuring out what it is they're going to do. A quick example of this is at Gaslight District in Cambridge, there is a large 80-foot square area in the courtyard that is tiled differently, and it has, if you step on the tiles, light comes out of them, sound comes out of them, and it creates sort of, it, as people walk on these things and I touch a tile that's somehow connected to the tile that you're on, the sound in my, coming out of my tile changes to a different beat that's more in line with yours. And while people walk around and sort of dance on this, they create a form of music. And each time it's very, very different. We call it River Lines because it marks the flood line of the 1974 flood in Cambridge of the Grand River, where people had to come together as a community in a moment of crisis. Whereas today we can come together as a community in an act of play. It's an extremely well thought out piece of what I would call public performance art. But when it first opened up, I noticed that people weren't really sort of gravitating to it. In fact, they were staying away from it. They felt they shouldn't walk on it because it looks different. And I went back to the designers of it, the people at Daily Tour du Jour in Montreal, and said, we need to give them rules and explanations. And they pleaded with me to say, Paul, don't do that. Give it time. Let people experiment. Let them take one step and hear some sound and then run away. And then let them do three or four. And let them figure out their own game, because then they will take ownership for it. And then they'll share it with other people. And it will grow that way. And it will be a place of community ownership within the city. And one of the stories that I've heard about it since that I truly, truly love. On the other side of this square, there one side is an event hall and the other side is a restaurant. And at one point during one of the summers, there is a wedding going on, two weddings going on, one in the hall, one in the restaurant. And somehow the wedding parties figured out a way of coming out into the square in between them and starting a dance between two wedding parties, people who never met before. People didn't know each other. But they figured they both saw one, I guess one part dance party came out and started dancing. So the other wedding party said, well, we should go do that too. And then they found a way of creating their own dance of two wedding parties.
That sounds awesome.
To me, that's what it's about. That is giving the community a chance to figure out what type of community it needs to become in order to thrive in the future. That creates a community that is in line with sociologist Richard Sennett's idea of fraternity versus tribalism. A tribe is created through a sense of sameness. We are the same, so therefore we are a group. But it's a fragile society because in order for sameness to be strong enough to withstand change, it needs to be constantly refined, constantly narrowed, constantly policed, constantly, you are the same, but are you same enough? And we see that today in the political arena, both on the far right and the far left. Are you left enough? Are you right enough? And people have to be constantly improving themselves. Whereas Richard Sennett's idea of fraternity is, It's not about being the same. It's about having shared experiences that allow you to negotiate your differences and allow you to understand that our differences can actually be an asset. I mean, in play, in sports, in games, we learn that our differences are actually good for us. Otherwise, we're all chasing the same ball, doing the same thing, and we lose the game. And so a fraternity builds a stronger, a more resilient society. We need infrastructure in our cities that allow us to build fraternity as opposed to infrastructure that inadvertently supports a tribal mentality, which sort of happens a lot in suburbs.
Very cool. And I think about shared trauma, and I know that's the opposite direction. You're not going for that. Mm-hmm. But really, there's a lot of research on how that bonds people. Also, you know, I know you mentioned sports there, and I think back of, you know, people I played sports with in university or even just like, you know, fun intramural ultimate frisbee. And I think of one professor, and I just really bonded with her through that experience. And now it's been, you know, over a decade. And every time I see her, it's like, hey, like we connect like it was yesterday through that shared experience, even though her and I at the time came from very different universes, to be quite candid, but we're able to bond through that shared experience. So I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, and that opportunity to have those places where people can have those shared experiences. I do have a curious question, no pun intended for you, but when we have and are fortunate enough to maybe have some of these spaces, how do we create that curiosity in the community to go and investigate and kind of, and I know you mentioned before you kind of struggled with that, like, hey, do we set up rules to teach people how to interact there? But my kind of question is a bit outside of that. How do you get those folks in that spot? Like, do you just wait, or are there recommended ways to encourage that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there are certain cues, certain invitations that can be and should be designed to heighten curiosity for people. In fact, I run workshops called Design for Joy workshops, once again, to help designers of cities shift their perspectives away from saying, well, we are creating a park, so what kind of park will it be? And well, what will we make or allow people to do in it? To what we're trying to do is create an environment where there's as much agency as possible, where there are just choices right from the moment you step onto the property. And those choices actually kind of force people to start using the part of their brain where curiosity comes from. There's two parks that I like to talk about, one in the city of Toronto called Bergey Park. People will know it as the Dog Fountain Park on Front Street, where there is this wonderful whimsical water fountain with sculptures of dogs all around it. And at the top of the fountain, a bone, a gold bone that's up there, and all the dogs are looking up at the bone. And it's so whimsical and full of all these little interesting Easter egg types of designs that people come and play around and hang out and get their pictures taken, but do all kinds of other things that no one would ever expect people would do just because the sense of joy sort of overtakes them. It's not a big park, but it's interesting because as you walk towards it, there's not really a direct line to the mountain. You have to sort of, all the paths kind of zigzag a bit. And then there's mounds of earth that cover the view of the mountain. You see something, it's attracting you. You can't quite get the full picture of it. And you have to figure out how to get to the thing. There's a bit of whimsy. It's like the start of the Yellow Brick Road. It goes in circles before it starts to go somewhere. And those are all very thought out cues that the designers are creating to not only invite you in, but to put your mind in the stage of play as you get to it. Another example is St. Pete's Pier in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is a 12-acre pier that goes out into Tampa Bay. And it is absolutely amazing in terms of the invitation to come and explore the zigzag, undulating landscape that gives you choice constantly, the lack of barriers between spaces, And the understanding that people playing is a form of performance art for everyone. There's a beach right beside the pier, and there are steps going down to it. And they could have just done, you know, two rows of steps. But instead, they created almost like bleachers. And the obvious thing is you can sit watching people on the beach doing what they do is great entertainment. So they created bleachers for people to sort of sit and watch that. But it's not like you have to go through anything. It's just the bleachers kind of appear as you're walking on these undulating paths. This is the art form, inviting people into curiosity and a sense of agency and control. And I guarantee you, anyone who walks out to the end of the pier probably takes a different path back from the pier just simply because you're constantly filled with choices. And it truly is a place where you feel like these people are playing as a city, and it's beautiful.
That sounds great. I think having, choice in an area, and I know you mentioned a couple of things I just wanted to touch on there, but the golden bone, like what a cool thing that is.
Yeah.
But having like little Easter eggs like that, and I'm a big fan of gaming with some friends, and a lot of the stuff there is, open world, and there's so many options that you can do, and there's different paths and, adventures to take and those sorts of things. And that's, I think, what really keeps people involved in some of those areas, because you can kind of, play it as you want. There's not a specific really, registered way to go, but it's, hey, you can kind of go about this however you want. And some people who haven't experienced that, they go, what do you mean? Like, I need structure. But once you embrace that, it's quite the experience. So I think that is great advice, giving people that choice, having those different paths.
You raise a good point in that this sense of choice and agency is prolific in the gaming world and in technology. And that ups the game. So people are going, well, if I can do it there, why can't I do it? Like, if I can do it in the virtual world, why can't I in the real world? And designing public spaces to, I said earlier, we're still designing public spaces to meet the needs of 30 years ago. That's not a good use of money. We should be designing public spaces to meet the needs of a generation and a future generation who have experienced agency in the virtual world and want it transposed into the real world. And I can take that a step further and say our self-imposed isolation, because of our tendency to do everything on our phones and to be, embraced in algorithms of social media, the only way we're going to pull people out of those very dangerous environments in terms of social health is by creating spaces that can compete with them. And that means, not building public spaces where we have a traditional swing set like in every other park, and not a baseball diamond, and not a, not a slide, and benches that are in rows as opposed to facing each other, or benches that look Victorian in their design. That's not going to lure people out of their, I'll just call it their digital addictions. A friend of mine said to me, I've got my kids and I can bark away at them as much as I want about screen time. I'm not going to win. But if I pull out the big bag of Lego and dump it on the floor, they drop their phones and they start playing. So, that's kind of what we need to do with our cities. Drop a big bag of Lego on our cities.
I love that. That is so cool.
And that's what we should do.
Especially with, building the cities of the future, right? Lego is on spot for that. I remember as a kid building so many different things, but if you don't have the blocks available, and it's difficult to do that. So I think that really leads in nicely to our next question for you, which is advice for economic developers. For someone working in economic development or the municipal sector in a different role who wants to learn more about the importance of play in their community, or build that infrastructure for the human spirit with that Lego, what would you recommend And are there specific communities? I know you had a couple examples for us today. I know you mentioned Scott and the Gaslight District, but there's maybe some other ones around Ontario where they should make a point to go to play and to experience that idea for themselves.
Well, I would invite people to go down to Gaslight District, but that's a little self-serving, but I would invite them to do that in Cambridge, Ontario. You know, there's always stuff free to do. You don't need a wristband. They have movie nights, which are pretty fantastic. And they program the movie nights so that there's always sort of an interesting twist, you know, Beetlejuice or something. And then people show up in their Beetlejuice costumes. Nobody says they have to, they just do. And it becomes truly the backyard for the city. And I love that it does do that. There is another park in Toronto, which is the Sugar Beach Park, which I think is very, very interesting in that it is a beach in the old industrial part of the waterfront where there were, you know, ships coming in and crane elevators, et cetera, that fill the ships. And it's like the society and citizens have taken it back from the industry. And it didn't even wait for the industry to leave, because right beside the beach is still a dock for Lakers to sort of pull in and get loaded up. So it's almost a little audacious and saying, oh, we're taking it back for us, and we're doing it right now. It's called Sugar Beach because it was a red path, sugar pier. And there's a lot of interesting cues of fun that it's almost like irreverent joy. There's metal umbrellas permanent there with chairs underneath them. But the umbrellas are kind of candy floss, pink. The beach itself is actually still a pier, so you can't walk into the water. You have to jump off the pier into the water if you want. But the beach itself is on an angle. So you walk onto how do I describe this? You walk onto the pier, and the beach is very small. But and as you're walking straight on down to the pier, the beach sort of cuts across and keeps nudging you as you're trying to get to the end. It keeps nudging you, say, come on, get on the beach. You know, let your hair down, have some fun. It's another beautifully designed area that people can't help but start making their own rules, start playing in their own fashion. And there are, you know, everyone's very, very familiar with, you know, Millennial Park in Chicago. But I, you know, I'll pick two things that are smaller that I just think are beautiful. I was just writing about this morning for one of my newsletter posts that, you know, even in cities today, when we create bike lanes to try and make the city more human, we do it with a mindset of control, so that the bike lanes almost become a very, very long, narrow, segregated part of our cities that are built for the efficiency of getting from one place to another, as opposed to something social and enjoyable. And we put them right along, you know, four-lane roads with exhaust fumes up and everything. In Winnipeg, there was I think it's still there, a bike lane that primarily its only signal of delineation was sort of a ground mural that were the lyrics of the Queen's song Bicycle. And it had written out, you know, I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to wear it where I like. Beautiful. That's there. Beautiful. People can figure it out. Everyone figures out where the bike lane is. It's very clearly delineated. And there's the invitation to let your mind play and contemplate and sing a song and all of those things. It's no sin to sing a song. There's no sin in seeing something that makes you smile and laugh with a stranger. In fact, given the state of society right now, I think it's what we need way more than a whole bunch of the other stuff we're trying to do. And then finally, the example I would give was in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. During COVID, they had a road that they closed down so people can walk on it. And then they decided to keep it closed permanently and then started to put different installations every couple hundred yards along the road. And a lot of them were really, really coolly designed lounge areas, seating areas, just lovely looking stuff. And I would walk by and see, you know, two people who don't know each other sitting there on their phones. So cool looking, but to what end? But 100 yards down, someone had purchased a bunch of spun chairs. You have to look them up online. Spun chairs, they're big, round, sort of plastic chairs that look like spools. But they're uneven, so you rock around on them. And when you roll on them and you roll backwards, you swear to God you're going to break your neck and fall over, but you don't. And they put a bunch of, they just took a bunch of spun chairs made by Herman Miller, dumped them in the road and left it. And everyone's on these things and everyone's laughing and they're laughing at themselves. They're laughing at other people that they don't know. We're there. Everyone is working to share the load of helping people learn how to do it, et cetera, et cetera. It was a moment of shared experience. And that shared experience was we're all imperfect humans. And it was wonderful. It was joyful. We were joyful in the one thing that we all have in common. We're imperfect. And I came running back at the time. This is about 4 years ago. I came running back to Scott Higgins and said, we need to buy 10 spun chairs and toss them into the Gaslight District courtyard. And they're great. They set the chairs in the middle every day. And by the end of the day, they're all over the place. And he put them back. And then the next day, they're all over the place again. And I gather, I think this past summer, that finally someone stole a chair. And instead of saying, oh, I guess we better fill out a police report, Scott told his staff to, no, you know, go do something really kind of weird and wonderful about this on social media. So they did sort of like a fake newscast on social media, clearly tongue-in-cheek newscast saying, you know, one of our chairs were stolen. And it went viral locally. And what I loved about it was the responses of people saying, you can't steal our chair. This is our chair, meaning this chair belongs to Cambridge. You got to bring the chair back. And to cut a long story short, eventually the chair was returned. To me, that's an example of creating community. That's the example of creating open-ended environments. These are the environments that people who are in the innovation economy, highly functioning, highly creative, thrive on. They like mixing things up. This is what they look for in their surroundings. These are the type of environments that make people feel like they like where they live. Imagine, let's design cities where people like to live there. And this idea of live, work, play, which has been our mantra for city building for a number of years, in chapter 5 of our book, The Joy Experiment, Scott and I propose play, live, work, as opposed to live, work, play. Play being the number one priority. Play being defined as the things that connect citizens to each other in an optimistic and positive environment, the things that can help people determine and define the type of community they want to become in the future.
Very cool.
I don't know if I answered your question.
No, that was perfect, Paul. And I like, you know, to use your words, mixing things up. I think that's always so much fun. And those spun chairs, I think, what a cool example. And kind of linking back to something you said earlier in the episode, but that sense of ownership. When you create these places where you offer people options and, you know, you don't lay out that path and then they get involved in these things and they build these relationships and they bond through those shared experiences, those become their experiences where, hey, you know, we have ownership of this. That ownership then spills out to like, hey, you know, this is our community and this is what's important. So not shocked that people had that reaction. Just something that they feel that they've had an experience with and are passionate about and see that that really brings their community together and very happy whoever decided to return that did bring it back. I think that's great. Or they were worried, you know.
Yeah. Or maybe they, you know, they were coerced into it. I don't know. The other issue, the other thing to mention about the spun chairs, that's way cheaper than the traditional path of building play infrastructure. So one of the things that I focus on with designers and when I'm actually teaching or running the Design for Joy workshops is a shift of perspective of what we're trying to do, shift of perspective in terms of the goals, opens up the possibility that we can have far more effect on a community without necessarily spending more money. In fact, we could be saving money by doing this because we're not doing the traditional stuff in a knee-jerk reaction. We're saying, well, hold on. What we're trying to do is create a certain experience, as opposed to saying, well, what we're trying to do is create a baseball diamond. And I'm not picking on baseball. I love baseball, but anyway. No, we're trying to create an experience. What's that experience? Okay, what are the different ways of us creating that experience? And it may turn out that we can save huge dollars by doing something a little bit surprising, a little bit different, a little bit like it's a prop in performance art, and people will figure out what to do with it, and it will be theirs, and they will come back to it over and over again because it's theirs. I think we're spending money on a lot of stuff that aren't necessarily the right things and not necessarily delivering the type of experiences we need, because many of our processes don't even ask that question. What type of experience are we trying to create? Like, you're going to answer a question you haven't asked. How's that?
That's perfect.
You know, all of our every downtown core in North America is suffering because of the shift to online retail, the bricks and mortar retail crisis, et cetera, et cetera. The question is what should downtowns be in the future? If we're still sort of hoping that, well, we'll do this, we'll do that, and we'll do some other cosmetic changes and return to what it was, that's just not realistic. Online shopping right now, I think, is between 60 and 70% of retail. Not many industries can survive having 60 to 70% of their business taken away. And that's not going to stop. In fact, it'll probably become more. So what do we want our downtowns to be? What type of experiences do we want our downtowns to create a stronger social fabric in our cities? Because that's both good socially and economically. We have to start asking that question. We have to start experimenting with designing for that. We have to start articulating what type of experience we want our downtowns to be and be prepared to do things differently. Otherwise, we're continually chasing something. Our funds are continually chasing something that's you know, not going to return. Not unless we all decide to no longer shop online. I don't know that many people are prepared to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, both of them there. But, you know, are people going to get away from that easy access from their phones? And, you know, going back to what we talked about a bit earlier about the generation that's really connected to those devices, I don't see that happening for the most part. However, I think, you know, going back to the dumping the Lego out, if there are things to do to keep people active, to keep them interested, to keep them with different options where, hey, they go someplace and it's kind of different every time. I think that's an area to hook them in, to bring them to those areas, to make it something where it's, you know, kind of going back to a discussion I had with a guy earlier on another episode. We talked about restaurants and the idea of, oh, you go there, you get your food and you leave, compared to you go there, you have a great experience. You understand the story of it. You maybe talk to the owners, you have a good experience. And now it's, hey, yeah, the food's good, but holy, this place was amazing because of how it made me feel and the experience that I had there. So I'm going to make sure I go back and I bring some friends with me next time. Same thing with, I think, the downtowns in the future.
Right. I mean, one alternative is to say, well, downtowns will just become another neighborhood, a different one. That's it. And maybe that's a viable approach, but I don't hear people wanting to give into that. And so we have to sort of start to say, before we start changing things, before we start making plans using existing, you know, priorities and existing assumptions, we need to start asking the question, to what end? To what end are we doing these things? Which tends to be more of a business question than less about, you know, I know that in the world of cities, you're playing a game that has no end to it. So it's a little hard. But to what end? What's our North Star in doing this and articulating that? I personally think, given the state of society right now and our inability to collaborate on much of anything, that to what end should be the connection of citizens to each other? That there should be a strategy binder that says this is our North Star and this is what we need to be focusing on. So how do we start asking the right questions and contemplating different approaches to reach that North Star?
Love that. And I think, to what end is really interesting to think about, why do we do some of these things? And to tie it into a previous episode I had with Brock Dickinson, we talked about the British railway trap and basically, are the things that we're doing today actually the right things, or are we just doing them because we've always done them that way?
Yeah.
And so I think that really speaks to what you're saying there. And I know, Paul, you have quite a way with words. I got to say, I know the last time I heard you speak, you said one line and I was going back through my notes just of your presentation and one really stood out to me. And you said that about half of it during this conversation as well, but it was a change in perspective through a change in language.
Yeah.
And I think that is so powerful. And as you do have a way with language, I was wondering if you could expand a bit on what that means.
The book, The Joy Experiments, was really to start a new conversation about city building, because it seemed to Scott and I that when it came to cities and where they're going and what to do about it, it was the same conversation, the same questions, the same people showing up, the same debates, the same arguments, the same result. And we felt that different words create different meaning. And through different words, we can start shifting perspectives. There's the old saying, perspective is everything. And it's an old saying because it's true. And so we wanted to create a conversation that started with different words connected and therefore then connected dots differently, which would then result in different conversations and different results. Stories are what society is. The stories we choose to tell about ourselves, that's what society is, really. So we thought long and hard about what words we would start to use. And I would say that in the joy experiments, we lean on, hesitant to say it, but I think we lean on theological words, joy, the human spirit, infrastructure for the human spirit, places of congregation as opposed to parks. Because what we are trying to get at is that there is something very important with the idea of a community, of a city. I mean, we have really, really, really let society go to the wayside, partially because I think it was a given. We will always, I mean, the bedrock of everything is a civil society. So we'll always have that. So we don't need to invest in it. We don't need to thoughtfully shape in it. It is just there. It's like mountains, civil society mountains. They're there. Beautiful, but they're there. We don't need to do anything. But we are now at a stage where the idea of a civil society can no longer be assumed anywhere, partially because of economic factors, various other factors, and partially because technology is at a point that it has never been before. If we want to have a civil society in the future, we have to start realizing we have a responsibility to shape it on an ongoing basis. We have to prioritize it, we have to value it, and we need to start putting some new thought and new infrastructure in place for it. Otherwise, we let it slide off the table because that's where it's going. So do we want it to slide off the table, or do we want it to be part of our daily experiences? Do we want to have a society that is similar to Richard Sennett's idea of fraternity, where through shared experiences, we can develop shared objectives and our differences can become assets and we can negotiate our way through that? Or do we want to just go with the tribal direction of you're in your group, I'm in my group, And my main job is to make sure I adhere to the sameness of my group, because everybody else is not in the group, and that's a bad place to be. So that's my thought on that.
Wow. That's pretty deep, Paul. There's definitely a lot to unpack there. I feel like we might need a follow-up episode.
I invite people to read the book, The Joy Experiment. I invite people to visit my website at paulconsultinginc.com and join my newsletter.
Yeah.
Because I'm continually trying to figure this stuff out as well. You know, it is a journey, and it's a journey for me as well. But it seems to be a journey that resonates with people. So if I can be the caretaker of this journey and get more people to join it, then that would be wonderful.
I love that. And I think I reflect back on a course I was so thankful to take during high school, and it was a leadership one. And we read this book, and one of the things in there that has stood out with me for my entire life now is the idea of challenging the process. And I think you really speak into that, and that really resonates with me. And one of the reasons I'm so thankful to have you on the show to have that discussion. And I know we're a little bit over time, so I just want to wrap up quickly. We do have a tradition of a mystery question, and had one in mind, but I decided to switch it throughout our conversation just because of our discussion of Lego and making sure we don't put all the bricks off the table and those sorts of things. So let's say you've got all the pieces you need. You've got the Lego, so to speak. You've got the support in the community. You've got the budget. What do you build? What does that look like? Or do you think, you know, that kind of depends on the community? Or is there like a good starting point you'd recommend for that?
I really think it depends on the community, depends on the performers, depends on their hopes, their joys, and their pain. But what I really, I answer your question, because I want to provide some answer. I'm really passionate about the idea of inviting people into the question, what type of community do we need to become in order to thrive in the future? Inviting people into that question is interesting, because it's not about, I don't use the word city. I say, what type of community? Community means the connection of people to each other. What type of community do we need to become in order to thrive in the future? I use the word thrive. I don't mean survive. Because if all we can do is imagine surviving in the future, I don't think we stand much chance of having a future, because we just won't put up the effort. But if we can imagine thriving in the future, I think we can get there. And I think that's the job of anyone involved in the social makeup of cities, nations, neighborhoods, streets, houses, homes, is what form of connection to each other do we need in order to thrive in the future? How can we imagine the future being joyful? It might mean that we don't have three-car garages. It might mean we don't have, you know, backyards with 8-foot fences around them. It might mean we have to live in smaller things, but maybe we can do all those things and be happier, because what we're giving up in terms of infrastructure of isolation, we are gaining in terms of infrastructure for the collective human spirit. And we're gaining a true sense of belonging. The word belonging right now is almost like a moniker. You belong. Well, what does belong mean? We don't know, but you belong. Yeah. But if belonging can happen through participation, we can create environments where people participate in an optimistic and joyful fashion. That creates belonging. You don't participate because you belong. You participate to belong. And that is a pretty vague answer for your question, but there you go.
I love that. I know for me, that was really impactful and deep, and I'm sure for a lot of other folks listening as well. So that draws us to a close, Paul, but I just wanted to say thank you so much for motivating my human spirit and for encouraging others to participate so that they can belong, and to really think about that question that you said, you know, what type of community do we need to become in order to thrive in the future, not just survive? So thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for creating this podcast and making it such a great venue for people like myself to share ideas.
Thanks for being a part of the conversation. If you enjoyed this episode of Hyperlocal, share it with a colleague or on LinkedIn and tag us. Every share helps us connect with more economic developers and continue telling these important local stories.